on the reading, aren't you?
No,
I think we came to the end of the row, and then we're coming up on this side. So, can you read for us what happened after the power analysis under the stats analysis? So we use one-way ANOVA from that sentence.
We use one-way ANOVA to examine differences in the number of pain-free days between groups. A significant difference between groups led to conduct of all possible pairwise comparisons using the Tukey-Kramer adjustment for testing multiple comparisons. Group differences in patient characteristics such as age, side, and type of stroke, time since stroke, table 1, shoulder range of motion and function, table 2, were examined using one-way ANOVA and the Kruskal-Willis-Wallace.
Okay, what did you get from that? What were you looking for in that? Like, really, what do you care about as clinicians? Was there a test for normalcy? No. Okay, but there was the power calculation, as we've been through before. Okay, results. Continue, Susan.
Oh, I'm taking notes. Results. 33 subjects were recruited over 2 years. One subject withdrew from the study on day one. The remaining 32 subjects were randomized into therapeutic strapping, N equals 10, placebo strapping, N equals 10, and control, N equals 12. One subject in the therapeutic strapping group was discharged early, completing 21 days of intervention. Two subjects in the control group were also discharged prior to study completion at day 11 and 18, figure 2. These three subjects were retained in group analysis, with discharge date noted as date of pain onset, although none of these subjects had reported pain by discharge.
What did you get from that?
They included them in the group analysis.
Excellent. They included their stats in the group analysis. Okay? Baseline characteristics, Moya had already read for us previously. Okay? The thing to note there is that there wasn't any indication of severity of stroke. That was, I've made a note about that. I mean, you wonder if stratification or any notation about severity of stroke would have.
Well, there's
motor
assessments, yeah. In terms of inclusion,
not using
that,
like a neurologic scale.
Right.
Yeah, like a
say it louder, Moya.
Not using like the Canadian neurological scale or something like that that physicians use for.
Right, so more than just a motor function scale.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because you could have a stroke that didn't give you as many motor implications as sensory or other cognitive implications. Okay? Notice that the variation on the, what's it called, the Ritchie Articular Index, it's a 4-point scale, right? Goes from 0 to 3, right? So it's a 4-point scale. What do you think would be the difference in how that data looks if it was a 15 or 20 or 50-point scale? Does that start making you think in regards to outcomes? Rona? Right. Okay, remember that's the primary outcome measure, the Ritchie Articular Index, which is a 4-point scale. The question with the 4-point scale is it sensitive enough to pick up changes? How good is it picking up between 0 and 1, between 1 and 2? Between 3 and 4, okay? And is it the same leap from 1 to 2 as it is from 3 to 4?
Mm-hmm.
So as a clinician, I'm always thinking, as I'm appraising an article to see whether I should change practice or not, I'm thinking, okay, is the outcome measure that they've used, is it clinically relevant? Would there be changes that I would anticipate in the patient that wouldn't be detected by this particular test? Does that make sense? Yes.
I'm not sure if they're even using it at scale, aren't they? Just looking at pain versus pain free. So they're looking at the yes, no, they're not looking at.
No, for the Ritchie Articular Index, it's 0 to 4. So they're giving it its numerical value.
But they say
yeah.
Yes or no. Because with one
pain, two or three is classified as
at
clinically,
risk.
They
at
determine
risk.
That's clinically significant pain. They say one as in terms of, this is in the last part of the paragraph, the first paragraph under outcomes, they say that they don't consider one to be clinically significant. They're looking at level two or three.
So if they wince or they wince and pull away, it
right.
counts as pain.
Exactly.
Well, let's
move on a little bit. We went through the baseline characteristics. Let's go under number of pain-free days. Who's
sorry,
next?
Just one other thing.
Go ahead, Sam.
It's an ordinal scale, and so the differences between a 0 and a 1 or a 1 and a 2, it's not quantifiable. You can't say that.
You can't discreetly break it up into a 1.2, 1.4, 1.6. It's not a continuous scale. It's like you said, an ordinal. You can't break it up into subscale. Okay. Can you read for us, please, under number of pain-free days?
Only one patient, 10%, developed pain in the therapeutic strapping group. In contrast, five patients in both the placebo strapping, 50%, and the control group, 42%, developed pain over the four-week period. Overall, patients in the therapeutic strapping group had a mean of 26.2, plus or minus 3.9, pain-free days. Placebo strapping, a mean of 19.1, plus or minus 10.8, pain-free days. And the control group had a mean of 15.9, plus or minus 11.6, pain-free days.
Okay, stop there. Tell me what you're reading about those means and those standard deviations. What do you notice about the standard deviations in particular?
They're
very large, from as low as one day to as high as 39 days, right? And particularly more, for there's a greater range for the placebo group and the control group than for the strapping group, okay? So, yes, go ahead.
Would you also look, in terms of the largeness of the standard deviations, is that in comparison to the mean itself? Then?
That's in comparison to the mean, yes. Okay. Continue, please. The one-way ANOVA.
The one-way ANOVA performed to examine group differences in number of pain-free days revealed a significant effect for group.
For group, meaning that whether you were control group or placebo or intervention group, okay, there was a difference.
Post hoc analyses revealed that this difference was between the therapeutic strapping and control groups.
Okay, so what they were saying there is that there was no difference between placebo and strapping. There was no difference between placebo and intervention. The difference was between control and strapping. Okay? Changes in secondary outcomes. Joan.
Some patients experienced improvements in shoulder function over the study period. One patient in the therapeutic strapping group achieved a motor assessment scale upper arm score of 4 by week 4. Two in the placebo strapping group achieved scores of 5, and two in the control group achieved scores of 3. However, the median motor assessment scale upper arm score remained low for all groups. Neither the therapeutic strapping nor the control group showed marked changes in range of motion over the 4 weeks. Only the placebo strapping group experienced loss of shoulder range in each direction. There were no significant differences in change in muscle tone. However, the placebo strapping group showed some reduction in tone.
Translation? Strapping didn't affect anything else other than pain. Okay, except in range of motion. The strapping group did decrease range of motion. Okay, let's look at the table two. Let's look at some of the outcomes in table two. Let's look down the column. You can see it's divided into columns, strapping, placebo, control, and now they give you a p-value for the comparison between it. Don't be fooled by there's just a column of p-value. Look down at the bottom of the table and you'll see that in the ranges, they also give confidence intervals, 95% confidence intervals. Remember we said if the confidence interval crosses zero, if there's a negative and a positive, it means that it's not significant. Okay? So, what can you tell me just very quickly, as clinicians, looking at those outcome measures, looking at those results. Look at the ranges in particular. Look at the confidence interval ranges for range of motion. 8 degrees, 12 degrees, minus 33 degrees, 14 degrees, minus 20, 9 degrees. There's quite a bit of variation, right? Okay, let's go to our worksheet under stats analysis and results. Was a testable hypothesis or objective stated? It wasn't phrased, remember, as a hypothesis, but as a purpose. Was the sample adequately described? They gave the baseline characteristics, but we thought we would also want to add in there neglect and some cognitive measure, right? If randomized, were the groups similar at baseline? We said, yeah, but they only gave p-values, not even in the table, but in the text, and there was no confidence intervals, remember? Okay. Was there adequate number of subjects? Who said? They did the power calculation for 10 per group. Okay? So we have to go with that. Okay? Generally, you want to see about 30 per group, but they did a power calculation based upon the result of a previous study. So we have to go with that.
And
yeah.
Because that one person dropped out, it's still okay?
Yep, as long as they analyze the data with them. Okay? Was the population normally distributed? Didn't state it. Okay? Was there hypothesis testing? Is the result statistically significant? Yeah, they gave their p-values. Was the change meaningful? Was the amount of fact that 5 subjects developed pain in one group and 4 in the other and none in the, only one in the strapping group? Would you say that that's clinically meaningful? Not thinking about statistics, but clinically meaningful? Would you be interested?
Yeah.
Yes. I would be.
Yeah.
I'd be very interested, especially if you only have 10 subjects. Okay? All right. If they show confidence intervals, did the interval cross 0? Which it did. Is the change what you would expect? Yeah? Okay. Have they made too many comparisons? Have they gone on a fishing expedition? Have they looked at a whole bunch of stats that were unnecessary? Not really. Confine themselves to what's appropriate. Were the methods described in detail? Yeah, they said what tests that they did. Were the methods appropriate? We don't know because they didn't check for normalcy. Okay. Were the dropouts reported?
Yes.
And were their results analyzed?
Yes.
Okay, let's go on to the discussion. Yes?
I don't understand confidence intervals and I don't understand how you're looking at it.
Okay, if you look at flexion change mean in table 2, 95% confidence interval, it says the strapping group, their mean change was 2 degrees. But that confidence interval, that's accurate between minus 8 degrees and positive 12 degrees. It crosses 0 from negative to positive, so it's not significant.
What is a 95%?
Means that if you were to do this study with a much bigger population, 95% of the time you would find that that mean would be between minus 8 and positive 12. Okay. Discussion.
The most important findings of our study was that the therapeutic strapping the hemiplegic shoulder prevented development of shoulder pain during rehabilitation in 9 out of 10 patients. Furthermore, this effect was found even when patients who failed to complete the study were included.
Okay, you can stop there, because there's a whole bunch after this in the discussion, so we'll just stop there. Can they state that? Why not?
You could have said that only one person developed pain, but it's not really the same when you reverse it and say that the strapping prevented the pain.
Correct. Okay, it's a technicality, but it's correct. What else would you like to, should that be prefaced in any way? That it wasn't just the strapping, but there were other co-interventions that weren't monitored. But in this group, only one developed pain. let's turn to page 293. And I'm sorry, the lady that was reading before for us. Can you read from the top of that paragraph then, please?
Given the demonstrated relationship between core function and pain, this finding is promising. Furthermore, despite potential for strapping to inhibit movement, we find no indication that either therapeutic or placebo strapping resulted in significant reduction in range of movement. It is important to acknowledge that current understanding of hemiplegic shoulder pain is limited. However, we can speculate about the mechanism by which shoulder strapping may prevent or slow pain. For strapping such as described here has the potential to change shoulder alignment and thus correct biomechanical problems associated with hemiplegic shoulder pain, such as subluxation. Whether subluxation is related to hemiplegic shoulder pain, however, remains controversial, with some studies supporting its relationship, but with the majority finding no relationship. It may also positively affect shoulder external rotation range, which has been associated with hemiplegic shoulder pain.
Okay, stop there. And Rona, can you read for us the next paragraph? Another mechanism?
Another mechanism, postulated in the sports literature, may be through increasing proprioceptive input with the use of strapping. This may benefit stroke patients with neglect and poor proprioception. It may also stimulate muscle activity around the shoulder, which may be useful in clients with flaccid paralysis. Apart from possible mechanical benefits, strapping may also act as a reminder to carers that a vulnerable limb requires careful handling. Although we found a significant difference in outcome for patients who received therapeutic strapping versus no strapping, we were unable to detect a significant difference in outcome between therapeutic and placebo strapping. This may indicate presence of any taping leading to increased care taken with these patients, therapeutic or placebo. Alternatively, it may indicate our study was too small to show a difference.
Okay, let's stop there. What are those two paragraphs telling us? The theories behind why it might have worked and the limitations of the study. Okay, speculation of the limitations. Let's look at the conclusion section of our worksheet then. Were the clinical implications explored? What they go on, and by the way, in the conclusions is to, in the discussion is to talk about other methods of taping, other designs of taping that could be different techniques of taping.
That explanation of how they think strapping works, would you not expect some of that information in the introduction?
It could go in the review of lit,
yeah.
And then you would explore it further. Generally, the discussion is a further exploration of the review of lit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you would say, but the problem with that study was that they didn't do this and they didn't do that. And when we compare these studies to ours now, we find this. That's generally what you find in a discussion.
Yeah.
Were the clinical implications explored? Looking from our worksheet. To a degree?
Yeah.
Okay. Were the conclusions restricted to a reasonable interpretation of the results? A little sweeping on that first statement. Okay, but generally not that bad through the rest of it. Were the limitations of the study reported? Okay. Turn over to the final page of the worksheet. By the way, this worksheet I originally developed with Pat Camp, who's doing her PhD. She's a PT doing her PhD. And she helped me with the stats part of this when we first ran a session like this. And then since then, I've added these other references. So there's the other references. So it's being developed over a two-year period. How can I apply the results to patient care? Were the studies patients similar to my patient? Were they similar to who you would be seeing? Depends where you work, of course. Okay. Were all clinically important outcomes considered? Perhaps they could have stratified by Brunstrom level or other co-interventions, right? Severity, whatever. Are the likely treatment benefits worth the potential harm and costs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not that labor intensive, is it? No. Okay, so what you've done now is you've done a step-by-step journal review, an article review, using the information that you, hang on just a sec, my or you can go to any of the references that are cited afterwards, like Pedro, for example, has an 8-point scale. Now that you know what concealed allocation and blinding and all those things are, you can either use one of those, you don't have to use this, or you can use this. I give it to you in this format because I like the fact that it's just questions, okay? So it stimulates discussion for a journal club rather than giving a numerical output. Okay, I just lost the projector for this. Just a second. Sandy, do you want to talk about some upcoming sessions while I'm...
Sure. So on February 8th, same time, same place, and then again on March 8th, same time, same place, we'll be looking at qualitative research, what it is, why it is, and then how you use it and when you use it. The session on February 8th will be with Wendy Hall, who's a professor at the School of Nursing. And the March session will be Judy Lynham, again a professor with the UBC School of Nursing, both with extensive backgrounds in qualitative research. And so stay tuned for that. I think it's going to be really helpful.
We've
still
got 10 seconds, Grace.
That's all I have to say.
Go, Sandy. Anytime now, we should be coming up with the next slide. Yes. Let me just whip through it down to the end. Okay, so where are we now? We've gone over the sessions on how to ask the question, how to acquire the information, and how to appraise quantitative articles. As Sandy said, the next two sessions will be on qualitative articles. The following session after that will be in how to apply evidence-based practice, the implementation part. Because research has shown that the barriers to evidence-based practice can be divided into three general categories: ability, opportunity, i.e., are there resources, is there support for doing it, do you have time, those crucial other things, and also implementation strategies. So the final session will be about knowledge translation, how techniques and strategies for, okay, once you've got the ability and once the opportunity in place, things such as our physio blog and the sessions that you can do on how to practice acquiring the evidence, once you have those things, what other strategies can we use for implementation? I want to say a big thank you because this is the last session that I'm leading. So I want to say a big session to Charlotte Beck, who was the librarian from UBC, who assisted me in the first session, to Maggie, who was the physio from Children's and Women's, who assisted me in the second session, and to Sandy, who assisted me today, to Yuji, who's been here each and every time and will be here for the subsequent three times and is a wealth of information, to Barbara, who is a librarian here at St. Paul's and is a huge source of information as well, to Joe Clark, who is the allied health leader who works with us with BCRSRNet, to Marcel Sprecher, who's our coordinator for BCRSRNet, and most importantly to you guys, because these things only come to fruition when people attend. So I thank you for that. And this is the updated three sessions that are still to come, and the bottom line is that we need them. Okay, so I want to thank you for your attention, and you're free to go to the meeting.